Good afternoon. It's my pleasure to be here today, particularly because it's my opportunity to return a favor to Dr. Jonathan Den Hartog, who was featured on my campus back in 2007 as our Constitution Day speaker that year. His topic was the origins of American constitutionalism. And it's my privilege to now return the favor by coming to your campus. And my talk will be entitled Seven Things About the United States Constitution That Every College Student Needs to Know. Seven things. Well, why seven and not six or not eight? The truth of the matter is I was constrained by two factors. Number one, short notice in giving this presentation. And so I had to come up with the topic quickly. Number two, I realized that this presentation would be scheduled immediately preceding your supper. And as someone who stands between you and your next meal, I had to make sure I kept it short. So we're aiming to cover seven things. I think we can do that in about an hour's time, allowing also for some audience questions and answers. Let's get started. The first thing I want to look at is that the U.S. Constitution is a written document. Now, that might seem obvious to you, but keep in mind that it was somewhat unique. The United States, as you know, rebelled against Great Britain, and that's how our country started. The British Constitution was not written down. The British Constitution was a lived tradition. Now, there are a few documents that bear witness to that British tradition, but the Constitution itself did not exist in a single document as such. So what would be some documents bearing witness to the British tradition? We could think, for example, of the Magna Carta from the year 1215, and some principles in that document would be limitations placed on the monarchy, and the idea that the monarchy had to acknowledge the nobility, and out of this noble class eventually was developing this body called Parliament. So even the relationship between the king and the legislature, and the legislature in turn with the people, all of those ideas perhaps are there in a seed form, ready to sprout and grow in the coming years. We also might look at the English Bill of Rights from 1689. This was enacted by Parliament, and it declared that there shall be free speech within Parliament. It also placed some limits on the monarchy. So again, the balance of power between two different branches of government, the legislature or Parliament, and the executive branch, or the monarchy. We see hints of what is to come in the American system, but it's not codified in a single place. There is no single written British Constitution. Another place we might look for the British tradition would be the philosopher John Locke. John Locke wrote two treatises on government that came out in the year 1690. And in his second treatise on government, John Locke talked about the mixed constitution, the idea of balancing the monarchy with the aristocracy and the democracy. So by the monarchy, he meant, of course, the king. The aristocracy referred to the House of Lords, the upper house of Parliament. And the democratic layer that John Locke had in mind was the House of Commons. The House of Commons was elected by property holders in England, and as such, it represented the most democratic layer of their government. Together with this, in the court system, there was a common law tradition that set the pattern for the way judges would decide cases, so that parties to those cases could have some reasonable expectation of the way that things probably would go based upon the experience of previous patterns. That's the idea of the English common law. And together with this, we might also add the writ of habeas corpus. William Blackstone traced that back to the reign of Edward I in 1305. Other scholars have tried to place it elsewhere, perhaps, but the point is it's been around for a while, and after a while, no one seems to question it. It seems to be obvious that people have a right to a writ of habeas corpus. Habeas corpus means they can't hold you in prison and detain you unless they tell you the charges that have been brought against you and allow you a chance to defend yourself in court. This is part of the received British tradition. It's part of the British Constitution. Well, the American Constitution, unlike that lived experience of the British, the American Constitution was written. And that's our first point then, that every college student should understand that the U.S. Constitution is a written document. And of course, a written document deserves to be read and to be studied. So, the United States left a clear paper trail. In fact, we see this already with the Declaration of Independence. Not only did the colonies simply revolt and declare themselves independent, but they actually issued a brief treatise, the Declaration of Independence, which goes into some philosophy of government, explaining the basis upon which they think it's appropriate to sever their ties to both the crown and parliament. And then they relate a history of abuses, where the king and parliament have both failed to respect their rights, and therefore they are declaring themselves ultimately to be independent. And so even there, the Americans left a paper trail. And this was to be continued with their first frame of federal government, known as the Articles of Confederation, that was ratified in 1781, and then again with the U.S. Constitution that superseded the Articles of Confederation. The U.S. Constitution was written in the summer of 1787. It was ratified by the requisite number of states in 1788 and has been in effect ever since then. Not only was the U.S. Constitution a written document, but also a supplement that soon was added. The Bill of Rights was written as well, and the Bill of Rights was ratified in 1791, consisting of the first 10 amendments to the U.S. Constitution. Now, the Bill of Rights, there's an interesting story there, because first of all, the lack of a Bill of Rights, the lack of a written Bill of Rights in the original Constitution was a bone of contention, and it stalled the process of ratifying the Constitution in states such as Virginia and Massachusetts, where people were deeply concerned that unless it was spelled out on paper, that the new federal government would be limited in its scope and could not constrain the people's liberty with respect to their freedom of speech, their religious liberty, their freedom of the press, their right to a jury trial, and other such things. Unless that was written out, many of the delegates in Virginia and in Massachusetts felt it would be better not to adopt the new Constitution at all. The big question was this, simply, how do you protect the people and their states from a tyrannical federal government? And the answer was, you limit the power of that government and you limit them with a document, a written document called the U.S. Constitution. And since the original Constitution fearfully was insufficient in that regard, quickly the process began to make some amendments. Now, the Founding Fathers viewed this writing, therefore, as a safeguard for preserving liberty. However, some of the founders questioned how much writing was necessary or how much writing was prudent. See, what if, for example, we spell out everything? Would that leave the impression that Congress has more power than should be obvious? In other words, the fact that we're adding an amendment that says, by the way, we have a right to free speech and Congress shall not abridge that right, that almost gives the idea that, oh, Congress might be thinking of abridging that right, and maybe Congress is thinking about other things. Should we spell that out too? Do we have to spell out everything in advance? What if we forget to mention something? Will Congress by default think that therefore it has the authority to do that unless we say that it doesn't? So what do we do? You know, Noah Webster was one of our founding fathers who thought that maybe we shouldn't spell so much out in advance. It should, in fact, be obvious that most laws and regulations will happen at the state and local level. The federal government won't get involved in the details of day-to-day life. So who needs a Bill of Rights that limits the federal government? Everyone knows the federal government shouldn't do those things anyway. That was sort of his attitude, and in a sort of parody against the movement for an explicit Bill of Rights, Noah Webster wrote, "Congress shall never restrain any inhabitant of America from eating and drinking at seasonable times, or prevent his lying on his left side in a long winter's night, or even on his back when he is fatigued by lying on his right." So it should be obvious Congress won't regulate the position in which we sleep. Therefore, why do we need to be so busy about restricting Congress explicitly in other matters when those should be obvious too? But many others were worried that it wasn't obvious, or that some future generation might not see it as being so obvious. Therefore, there was a move to limit through writing what the federal government can do. The result then is the Bill of Rights, a written document, just as our Constitution is. Finally, one way to put this all into perspective, just to remember the big picture, is the whole point of the Constitution. James Madison, one of the architects of our Constitution, noted that over in Europe, they had things called charters. Charters were granted by power in order to confer liberty. In other words, the king who held power would power would grant to the people certain liberties that they may enjoy. But in America, it was the opposite, because remember the first three words of this document, we the people. The U.S. Constitution is a written charter of liberty by which the people grant power in certain limited respects to portions of their government. And the Bill of Rights reminds us that there are to be limitations on what the government can do as it exercises those powers. So, thus far, number one, the Constitution is a written document. The purpose of writing is to safeguard the people's liberties. Let's continue now with number two. The U.S. Constitution was designed for a republic, not for a democracy. Benjamin Franklin once was asked by a lady, actually, as he walked out of the Constitutional Convention back in the summer of 1787. She said, "Well, doctor, what have we got, a republic or a monarchy?" And a delegate from Maryland, Dr. James McHenry, records Franklin's response. He said, "A republic, if you can keep it." So what is a republic? Res publica, the Latin phrase from which our word republic comes. Res publica refers to a representative government that serves the common good. By the 18th century, this meant protecting natural rights through a balance of power among multiple layers of government. The key was to prevent any one person or group of persons from exercising too much power for too long. And so the U.S. Constitution established a federal republic, spreading power out among different branches of the government in such a way as to represent the people's best interest and to protect their rights. But the Constitution did not stop there, for it also guaranteed to each state a similar form of government. In Article 4, Section 4, we read, "The United States shall guarantee to every state in this Union a republican form of government." And when I say republican form, I don't necessarily mean the Republican Party of today is contrasted with the Democratic Party of today. Rather, by republic, I simply mean a representative government that is to serve the common good. A democracy, a more direct government by the people, was viewed as being dangerous because of its tendencies toward mob rule, toward a tyranny of the majority. That being said, the founders still valued democracy, but they saw it as one component among many in their multi-tiered government. Over in England, they had done the same thing. Recall the mixed or balanced constitution with the monarchy, the aristocracy, and the democracy, the democratic layer being the House of Commons in Parliament. Well, in America, the House of Representatives was the most democratic layer. And that was an important component, but it was something to be balanced out by other components, including the United States Senate and the presidency, for example. Notice, too, that the American system is balanced not by three layers of social hierarchy, like the British system, the aristocracy as compared to the common people, but rather the American system is balanced by three kinds of powers: the executive power, represented by the president, the legislative power, represented by Congress, and the judicial power in the courts. Now, over the years, the nation has become increasingly democratic and less republican, and I'll highlight several transitions that have brought that about. The first would be from the early 1800s, when there was a shift in how presidential electors were selected. The president is elected by not the voters directly, but rather by a group of electors from each state. We call it the Electoral College today. And initially, the state legislatures designated that the state legislatures themselves would be the ones to select the presidential electors. So in other words, each state's legislature got to decide which group of people would vote for president on behalf of that entire state. Nowadays, it's a direct popular vote, and those votes are then counted per state and go toward whoever the elector should then be. That shift took place in the early 1800s. By the 1830s, just about every state had a popular election for presidential electors rather than a designation from the state assembly. A second change that took place, moving things from a republic toward a democracy, would be the national citizenship that was established by the 14th Amendment. This was ratified in the year 1868, just a few years after the Civil War. And the main point here was to ensure that all the recently freed slaves would have full rights of citizenship throughout the United States. The language of the 14th Amendment speaks of citizenship, and it also speaks of all persons being guaranteed certain rights that the states must respect, and if they don't, Congress is authorized to have the federal government intervene to ensure that each state respects the rights of each citizen. And so the policies in America have become decreasingly on a state-by-state basis and increasingly on a federal basis. And part of this has to do also with the popular election of U.S. senators, which was developed in the 17th Amendment, adopted in 1913. Prior to that amendment, U.S. senators were chosen by their state legislatures, not by a direct vote of the people. The rationale was that the federal government should represent not only we the people, but also all of the states. It was a federation of state governments, and therefore the U.S. Senate was selected by state legislatures. In 1913, an amendment changed that, the 17th Amendment, making the election of senators come directly from the people. The result is a shift toward democracy and a shift toward viewing the nation as one giant democracy. Instead of viewing the nation as several separate republics, each state being a republic, then lined up into a federated republic of the federal government. Finally, I might add one other component on the drift toward democratization, and that would be the political tests that now apparently apply to judicial appointments. And I think over the past 30 years or so, we've seen this especially, where anytime there's a presidential election, people get very concerned over who the new president might be and how that president might determine the future makeup of the federal courts, especially the Supreme Court. And so gone is this idea that the judges are politically independent and that they will make their decisions based simply upon the law. But rather, we have this assumption, and perhaps it's a valid assumption, but it is an assumption that almost expects judges to be politically biased, and therefore we become deeply concerned over who will appoint them, who will be elected to the presidency, because it is the president who appoints judges. So in summary, we've had several factors shift us less from a republic and more toward a democracy. And I want to suggest to you that this has some negative consequences. We often think democracy is a good thing, and in some ways, of course, it is, but I think there also are some pitfalls to be wary of. One is that citizens look increasingly to the federal government, not to local or state government, to receive the benefits that they desire. They see the federal government not as representing their states so much as representing them personally, and they increasingly look to the federal government for their best interests. Federal office holders, in turn, meanwhile, become increasingly attuned to popular mandates. They're concerned about re-election. It won't suffice simply to keep a state legislature happy. They must keep the people at large happy. Political parties, therefore, secure power by catering to popular factions. As James Madison warned in his Federalist paper of 1787, the public good is disregarded in the conflicts of rival parties, and that measures are too often decided, not according to the rules of justice and the rights of the minor party, but by the superior force of an interested and overbearing majority. And that's the danger we have now, that there can be an interested and overbearing majority that can secure power in the federal government and rule democratically, as it were, but a tyranny of the majority. In fact, that phrase, tyranny of the majority, was suggested by John Adams in his 1788 book, A Defense of the Constitutions of Government of the United States of America. Thomas Jefferson wrote to James Madison in 1789, "The tyranny of the legislature is really the danger most to be feared and will continue to be so for some time to come." Well, that was right at the time that our new Constitution was being adopted. Already the Founding Fathers were concerned about things drifting too much toward a democracy, and they wanted to maintain balance of power spread thinly throughout the government so that it could represent broadly all of the people rather than only the majority faction. A French observer named Alexis de Tocqueville came to America in the 1830s to observe democracy at work. He wrote a book called Democracy in America. And there he noted, on the one hand, that authority originates in the will of the majority. But he said, on the other hand, not only the majority of this nation or that nation should be considered, but also the majority of all humanity. In other words, de Tocqueville realized that for a society to remain stable, we cannot allow simply whoever holds the majority in one particular year to have total sway, but everyone hopefully would contemplate the greater good and would reflect on the purpose for which government exists, the nature of man, and would think of the majority of all humanity throughout history in order to arrive at a wiser decision. The alternative is simply to let one faction dominate whoever may hold control for a time, and this tyranny of majority reduces the republic into a democracy in the pejorative sense of that word. Edmund Burke, in his Reflections on the Revolution in France in 1790, spoke of the tyranny of the multitude as being a form of multiplied tyranny. And as we know, things got pretty ugly in France. They remain more stable in America. De Tocqueville, a Frenchman himself, was amazed at that. He marveled over the American system, and therefore he said that the American democracy must be protected by the common recognition by all mankind as to what is good and what is evil. And by the way, this common recognition of what is good and what is evil, that requires that we talk about something else, doesn't it? Let's continue then to number three, where we'll talk about morality. Number three, the framers of the U.S. Constitution shared a common tradition of natural law which was supportive of natural rights. There are three core natural rights that political philosophers in the American tradition have underscored, and it actually goes back to the British tradition. John Locke, in his Second Treatise on Government, spoke of life, liberty, and property. Thomas Jefferson, in the Declaration of Independence, similarly wrote that we are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights, and that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Jefferson's pursuit of happiness largely centered on the possession and use of private property, and so he essentially agreed with Locke, who spoke of life, liberty, and property. But what is the source of these natural rights? Our founding fathers recognized that the source of our right to life, our right to liberty, and our right to property is God. God, who has so designed human nature that we have these rights. The source is not the government. Consider, for example, William Blackstone, who wrote in his Commentaries on the Laws of England in 1771, "This will of his maker is called the law of nature. These are the eternal, immutable laws of good and evil to which the Creator himself in all his dispensations conforms, and which he has enabled human reason to discover, so far as they are necessary for the conduct of human actions." So God has so created us that he has embedded within us certain purposes, as well as a sense of reason by which we may discern the difference between good and evil. And this we call the natural law. In Virginia, when they enacted a law to protect religious freedom in 1786, it's interesting that they didn't just pass a law saying people have religious freedom and shouldn't be forced to pay taxes to support a church against the dictates of their own conscience, but they also added another section to that law. Let me read it to you. "We are free to declare, and do declare, that the rights hereby asserted," that is to say, for religious freedom, "are of the natural rights of mankind, and that if any act shall be hereafter passed to repeal the present or to narrow its operation, such act will be an infringement of natural rights." Jefferson, who wrote that, and the Virginia Assembly, who adopted it, realized that some future generation might be different, that the legislature might choose to repeal the Religious Freedom Act and start a new state church or something like that. But what they chose to do is go on record and say, caution, because if you repeal this act that guarantees religious liberty, you're not only going against the consensus of today's legislature, but you are actually going against the law of nature. This is one of the natural rights of mankind, and that if any act shall be hereafter passed to repeal the present or to narrow its operation, such act will be an infringement of natural right. Now, the protection of natural rights requires something. It requires moral education that fosters civic virtue, and this should start in the home. Historians refer to it as republican motherhood, the practice among the first few generations of our republic of mothers in particular to instill upon their children the virtues of American political principles so that they could rise up and become effective citizens. Benjamin Rush wrote in his Thoughts on Female Education, published in 1787, the same year the Constitution was written, that the equal share that every citizen has in the liberty and the possible share he may have in the government of our country make it necessary that Our Lady should be qualified to a certain degree by a peculiar and suitable education to concur in instructing their sons in the principles of government and the principles of liberty and government. So here he saw the importance of women being educated just as men in what today we might call political science, in order that children may learn this from their mothers in the home. And it wouldn't just be from their mothers in the home, there also would be lessons in school. Again, the same year that the Constitution was written, 1787, we find Congress operating under the Articles of Confederation, adopting that famous Northwest Ordinance. And there they write, "Religion, morality, and knowledge, being necessary to good government and the happiness of mankind, schools and the means of education shall be forever encouraged." So why do we need schools? To educate. Why do we need to educate? So people have knowledge and morality and religion, in order that they may be citizens who exercise civic virtue, which is necessary to hold our republic together for the protection of our natural rights. James Madison reflected thus in Federalist number 51, "But what is government itself but the greatest of all reflections on human nature? If men were angels, no government would be necessary. Alas, men are not angels, and government therefore must constrain and punish those who attempt to deprive others of their natural rights." In the 20th century, we have seen a tension that continues today over this issue of natural rights. Will we preserve the heritage our founding fathers have given us, or will we replace it with something else? In other words, how natural, how inalienable are these rights of which we have spoken, the right to life, to liberty, and to property? The United Nations, in its Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1948, states in Article 29, "These rights to life, religious liberty, free speech, a paid vacation, and several others, and freedoms may in no case be exercised contrary to the purposes and principles of the United Nations." Is that the same in saying that those are natural rights? Is that the same as saying that those rights are inalienable, when they may be in no case exercised contrary to the purposes and principles of the United Nations? John F. Kennedy, in his inaugural address of 1961, hearkened back to the philosophy of our founding fathers. Kennedy said this, "The rights of man come not from the generosity of the state, but from the hand of God." The United Nations seems to be suggesting the opposite. And unless the suggestion be misunderstood, the Constitution of the Republic of Cuba, in Article 53, makes it quite clear. For there we read that citizens have freedom of speech and of the press. But that does not conclude the sentence. It reads in total, "Citizens have freedom of speech and of the press in keeping with the objectives of socialist society. Material conditions for the exercise of that right are provided by the fact that the press, radio, television, cinema, and other mass media are state or social property and can never be private property. This assures their use at exclusive service of the working people and in the interests of society." And so there is a tension seen quite sharply during the Cold War period between a communist or a socialist leaning system, which regards the government as the grantor, even the creator, and potentially the destroyer of so-called rights, compared to the American system in which our founders professed that God had so designed us and so created our human natures that intrinsically we have natural rights, rights that are inalienable, rights to life, to liberty, and to property. And let me finally just say that this conviction of our founding fathers, though influenced by Christianity and compatible with Christianity, does not depend upon Christianity. That is why number 3 says that the framers of the U.S. Constitution shared a common tradition of natural law, supportive of natural rights. That's true of the Christian founders. It's true of the deist founders. It's broadly true of many different religious traditions, that there is a conviction that God exists, that He created us, that He designed us in a particular way, that the difference between good and evil has been written into our consciences, is discernible by human reason, and also that the purpose of government is to protect our lives, our liberties, and our property. That is the basic natural law, common tradition of our founding fathers.
and I would suggest it deserves to be preserved today among all competitors. We continue next to number four. Number four, the U.S. Constitution was unique in separating the three powers of government. We can easily take this for granted because already from elementary school you learned that there are three branches, the legislative, the executive, and the judicial. What you might not realize is that this was somewhat a new idea. And Charles de Secondat, Baron of Montesquieu, a French political philosopher of the 1700s, wrote in his work of 1751, The Spirit of the Laws, that we should have those three powers separated in government. And in case you've never heard of Montesquieu, let me assure you that our founding fathers did. Alexander Hamilton, one of the architects of our Constitution, wrote in Federalist number 78 of the celebrated Montesquieu. And in fact, Montesquieu was one of the most frequently quoted writers by any of the framers of the U.S. Constitution. Highly influential. Now, at that time, Great Britain was the finest example of Montesquieu's doctrine of separating the powers. The Federalist writers emphasized that the U.S. Constitution would offer even more checks and balances than the British system, which Montesquieu had praised, and therefore they said the U.S. Constitution certainly deserves to be ratified because it would, in fact, follow through on that philosophy in a more thorough way. In fact, the United States became the first nation ever to have an independent judiciary. Over in England, what their equivalent of the Supreme Court would basically be the King and the House of Lords deciding the matter. And so you have there the monarchy is on the one hand executive in function, but also judicial. And likewise, the House of Lords on the one hand is part of the legislature, part of Parliament, but also having a judicial function as well. In America, the Supreme Court is completely separate from the Congress and from the presidency. And that has been important in separating the powers and balancing them. Alexander Hamilton had to address the concern that some people had, however, about separating the judicial branch, that it might become too powerful. Here's what he wrote. Whoever attentively considers the different departments of power must perceive that in a government in which they are separated from each other, the judiciary, from the nature of its functions, will always be the least dangerous to the political rights of the Constitution, because it will be least in a capacity to annoy or injure them. At times, today, we might wish the judiciary was perhaps less dangerous than it has become. But initially, it was viewed that a matter would only come to the courts after it had already been through the other channels, and that the courts could only act upon the Constitution in relation to laws that had been passed under it and couldn't really invent new ideas of their own, and therefore they were considered to be less dangerous than the people from that standpoint. Well, however imperfectly the separation of powers may occur in practice and the balancing of them, it remains to this day an important theoretical commitment that we have in America, calling us back to our roots, that the three powers of government are to be kept distinct. And in fact, here in Minnesota, we see an echo of the federal Constitution. Our Minnesota Constitution in Article 3, Section 1 states, "The powers of government shall be divided into three distinct departments, legislative, executive, and judicial. No person or persons belonging to or constituting one of these departments shall exercise any of the powers properly belonging to either of the other departments, except in instances expressly provided in this Constitution." So there, too, we have a clear indication that it is important to keep those functions separate. Number five, the framers of the U.S. Constitution purposefully designed the Electoral College. Sometimes we feel embarrassed about the method by which we elect our president. Sometimes we feel confused because of instances in which one candidate receives more popular votes but not more electoral votes, and so that candidate ends up losing. Why does this happen? Number five, the framers of the U.S. Constitution purposefully designed the Electoral College to happen precisely that way. You see, the president was to be both a national leader and a leader selected by the several states. And the framers thought that a multi-step process would provide the greatest safeguard against corruption. Again, they wanted to prevent any one person or group from wielding too much power for too long of a time. And so what did they do? They decided that each state may choose a number of electors equal to that state's full representation in the two houses of Congress. They decided that each state legislature would determine the method for choosing its electors. As I mentioned before, initially the state legislatures themselves chose the electors. Eventually, the states adopted laws transferring this responsibility to the popular vote. Occasionally, electors disregarded the popular vote and voted according to their personal will. Most states are winner-take-all, but a few are not, and so the popular vote might even be the popular vote might even be separated out into legislative districts or by another method in a couple of states. But most states, the majority of popular votes for the whole state claims all of the electors for that state. In any case, once the electors have been selected, they have a job, and each elector is to cast two ballots. To become president, a candidate must receive a vote from the majority of the electors. Second place becomes vice president. But if no one receives enough votes to become president, then the House of Representatives would break the tie. And in the case of a tie for vice president, then the Senate would decide the winner. Later, this was changed in 1804 with the 12th Amendment, revising the procedure to accommodate the practice of political parties in naming candidates to a ticket, such that a candidate for president may team up with a candidate for vice president and run together on a common party ticket. Well, all this gets to be confusing. The simple question is this: who should elect the next president? Some people might say Congress, since the president and the vice president have the job of implementing the laws that are passed by Congress. Others might say the states, since the president and the vice president represent the federation of states that we call our federal government. And finally, the people. Doesn't the preamble of the Constitution say, "We the people"? Well, then shouldn't the president be elected by the people? Well, as you can see, the Electoral College split the difference. It involved all of these groups in different ways through a method that seems complicated, but the complexity was on purpose. Once again, to prevent any one person or group of people from wielding too much power for too long of a time. Finally, you might still wonder whether this is all fair. After all, doesn't sometimes a candidate win the popular vote but lose the electoral vote? Who should then be president? Well, let me suggest an analogy from sports. If you believe that the World Series is fair for baseball, then you should believe that the Electoral College is fair for presidential elections. Who wins the World Series? Is it the team winning the most games in the series? Yes, it is. But did that team necessarily score the most runs in the series? Not necessarily, because that team may have won one game in a lopsided way with a very high score, but lost several other games, thereby losing the series. In the same way, the election to the presidency is balanced, where a candidate must be successful in quite a number of states, and especially in quite a number of highly populated states, in order to win the nation as a whole. Finally, I might also ask, is it unfair to skip the final game of the World Series if you already know who won based on the previous games and how they turned out and whether someone already got a majority? Well, of course it is. Even though you might want to watch more baseball, you realize that the series is over. In the same way, sometimes we know the winner of the president even before we've counted all of the states, because that person received enough electoral votes from the other states. For my part, I hope the Electoral College remains to stay. If anything were to be changed, I would revert the winner-takes-all scheme back to a weighting system that treats each congressional district separately. We come now to point number 6. Over time, the U.S. Constitution has become less federal and more national. By federal, I mean a federation of states. By national, I mean one people under a common national government. The U.S. has always been both, but the branches, or rather the balance, has increasingly tilted toward the national rather than the federal end of the spectrum. The 14th Amendment, as I mentioned before, established national citizenship. Section 1 reads, "All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws." The due process and equal protection clauses mean that the federal government may intervene to prevent a state from denying a person these rights. The big question is, what sort of rights are included under due process? What sort of rights are included under equal protection? The Supreme Court has incorporated the Bill of Rights under the 14th Amendment, binding state and local governments to uphold everything that is said of Congress, the federal government, in the Bill of Rights. This began in a court case back in 1937 under Palco, called Palco v. Connecticut, where the court began to outline this doctrine known today as selective incorporation. The principle was this, that only those rights that are fundamental to the concept of ordered liberty, such as the freedom of speech, apply also at the state and local levels. So, in other words, the First Amendment says this, that Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. The First Amendment doesn't mention anything about the state legislature or the town mayor abridging free speech. But the court in Palco v. Connecticut, 1937, laid down the doctrine of selective incorporation, saying that when we're dealing with something like free speech, because it is so fundamental to ordered liberty, that we must bind the states to also adhere to what the First Amendment says regarding Congress. So it says Congress may not pass any law, and it means neither can any state legislature pass a law that abridges free speech. Some years later, the court increased this level of incorporation to what scholars call total incorporation. Here, the idea is that all of the rights that the people have against the federal government in the Bill of Rights also apply to state and local government. So the right to a jury trial, the right to protection against double jeopardy, and so forth. And some of these already had been included in state constitutions, but not all of them. And so progressively, the court was trying to apply more and more of them at the state level through the 14th Amendment that says that the federal government can guarantee to everyone a sense of equal protection of the law as a citizen of the United States. Finally, there's a move also towards something called total incorporation plus. This means that even rights that are merely implicit in the Bill of Rights also apply at the state and local levels. The chief example of this would be the so-called privacy right, discovered by the court in the emanations from penumbras surrounding the Bill of Rights. And that phrase is theirs, not mine. This case was called Griswold v. Connecticut, 1965. The word privacy does not appear in the Bill of Rights. Neither does the phrase birth control. This case had to do with birth control. And what the court said is that there are emanations, that is to say things that radiate outward from penumbras, that is to say fuzzy shadows that surround the language of the Bill of Rights. And from that, the court construed that the idea of privacy is at least hinted at in the Bill of Rights, and they decided to declare that, therefore, under the Bill of Rights, we have a privacy right, which would include the use of contraception. And since we are incorporating this under the 14th Amendment, we will make sure that not just the federal government, but also state governments must now respect this newfound right to privacy that became known as reproductive freedom. Eventually, the same thing was expanded by the court in Roe v. Wade to cover abortion. So again, this is called total incorporation plus, and the idea is that even rights that are not explicitly mentioned in the text of the Bill of Rights, but might be construed by the court to be implicit in that text, can now be applied also to limit the legislative jurisdiction of the states and say that the people may claim that right. Another example to consider would be the incorporation of the First Amendment. The First Amendment speaks not only of free speech, as I've mentioned, but also religious freedom. It says that Congress shall pass no law that would abridge people's freedom of religion, nor establish, nor respect any establishment of religion. And that no establishment clause meant that there could not be a national church. England had a national church, the Church of England, with the monarch being the head and with parliaments passing laws that decided topics of doctrine, for example. But in America, there was to be no national church. Congress would not have this power. However, each state could determine on its own, in its state constitution, whether or not the state would have a state church. And in the case of Massachusetts, they had a state church at the time of the Revolution, and they continued to have this state church until the year 1833. Finally, the Massachusetts state church was disestablished in that year, and it was done so for practical reasons. It was not a principled concern. It wasn't a constitutional concern with regard to the First Amendment. Remember, the First Amendment says Congress shall not do this. It doesn't say anything about the Assembly of Massachusetts having a state church. The practical concern was this, that the people who had been getting tax money to support their own church were kind of falling out of power, and another more liberal group of theologians were gaining power, and the thought was now the taxpayer money would go to the liberal church instead of the conservative one. So before that happens, let's just vote to make sure it goes to no church. Let's disestablish the church. It was a purely practical concern. However, by the mid-20th century, the First Amendment became tied to state and local governments with respect to this religious establishment clause. How did that happen? Well, once again, it's this idea of incorporation, that the Supreme Court held that even though the First Amendment only limits Congress with respect to people's religious liberty, through the 14th Amendment, which says we are all guaranteed a national citizenship and the protection of equal rights by Congress if the states fail, or by the federal government if the states fail, therefore federal courts have held that no state or local government may respect an establishment of religion or limit people's freedom of religion either. Another case that we might mention briefly would be Brown v. Board of Education. Again, the government, the Constitution doesn't mention education, and under the 9th and 10th Amendments, we would understand education to be reserved for the states and for their people to deal with. However, through the 14th Amendment, with this idea of citizenship being tied to education, the court felt that it now became a federal issue by the mid-20th century and ordered that all schools be integrated. Some of these changes may, of course, be things that we would approve of. My point is not taking sides at the moment, but simply making this of an observation. Number six, over time, the U.S. Constitution has become less federal and more national. I think that's a significant shift, and it's largely due to how the courts have treated the 14th Amendment. In fact, it's been said that history, the history of philosophy, is but a footnote to Plato. Similarly, we might say that the history of constitutional law has become but a footnote to the 14th Amendment. And next, we come to the last of our seven things that every student should know about the Constitution. Number seven, the U.S. Constitution remains a monument to humanity's quest for ordered liberty. There's a delicate balance, isn't there? If we have too much order imposed, then we end up with a totalitarian government. If we have too much liberty, on the other hand, then we could end up with an anarchy of chaos. And so the Founding Fathers recognized that we needed these two things to be balanced. The Constitution was part of their effort to balance order and liberty into an ordered liberty. More recently, George W. Bush said that freedom is the hope of every human heart, the right of every person, and the future of every nation. In other words, his expectation was that freedom, as Americans understand it, is something we can export to the rest of the world. This, of course, is a claim with some controversy, because George W. Bush used that statement to support the war on terrorism. Is ordered liberty, therefore, America's greatest export? Well, Arnold Schwarzenegger, as governor of California, said America remains the great idea that inspires the world. Is that true, that America is the great idea that inspires the world? Well, if it is, then I think it's going to come down largely to America's ability to balance between order and liberty, to achieve ordered liberty. The Constitution has been one of the important tools that we've used to do that. Of course, with great ideals comes great responsibility, and for that reason, many of us tremble to think of the awesome responsibility that our government exercises, not only within our own nation, but also at times and often overseas. In conclusion, I'd like to tell you about something that I do in my course at Bethany Lutheran College entitled The U.S. Constitution and the Early Republic. We discuss examples of the Constitution being disregarded in that course. And then what we do is we tear out any section of the Constitution which has been abandoned. Finally, we look at what is left, and usually it is not much. Then I give each of my students a sealed envelope. Inscribed on the envelope are the words, "For the Custodian of American Liberty." I ask them not to open it until they feel ready for that responsibility. Inside, of course, is a fresh copy of the U.S. Constitution with nothing torn out. To you, I say also, become a custodian of American liberty. First, understand your constitutional heritage. Perhaps you will enroll for Dr. Den Hartog's course on the American Revolution. Or, better yet, maybe you'll switch colleges and you'll enroll in my class instead. Outside of the classroom, I'd encourage you, as part of your quest for lifelong learning, to read the Federalist Papers, which describe the defense, present the defense that our framers of the Constitution presented when seeking to have that constitution adopted. There's also a collection known as the Anti-Federalist Writings, and so you can read the other side and get the full sense of the controversy from this time period. Pass on your constitutional heritage as well. Some of you, I know, will become teachers. Realize that the revision of state standards for social studies across our country, including right here in Minnesota, has a tendency to devalue some of the things I've been talking about this evening. The Constitution and Bill of Rights are read less and less. The principles of natural rights are spoken of less and less, and when they are mentioned, often they're mentioned dismissively. It's important that we have teachers who will cherish our founding heritage in order to pass it on. It's important that we have parents who will revive the tradition of Republican motherhood, Republican fatherhood in your families. Barack Obama, in his first inaugural address back in 2009, said this: "It is a parent's willingness to nurture a child that finally decides our fate." Isn't that true? It is a parent's willingness to nurture a child that finally decides our fate. It's one of the wisest things our current president has ever said. And so I urge you, when you're blessed with children, to become that kind of parent, to defend your constitutional heritage by becoming an educated voter as well. Write to your elected officials. Campaign for worthy candidates. Consider running for office yourself. Submit letters to the editor. Write for blogs. Remember that the text message and the tweet, like the pen of olden days, are mightier than the sword. But whatever you do, be sure to avoid doing nothing. Apathy is the death blow to ordered liberty. As Ronald Reagan said, freedom is never more than one generation from extinction. We didn't pass it to our children in the bloodstream. It must be fought for, protected, and handed on for them to do the same. Or one day we will spend our sunset years telling our children and our children's children what it was once like in the United States where men were free. No, don't be silent, but learn. Learn and then speak from your knowledge, as did Martin Luther King Jr. in the last great speech of his life when he said, "Somewhere I read of the freedom of assembly. Somewhere I read of the freedom of speech. Somewhere I read of the freedom of press. Somewhere I read that the greatness of America is the right to protest for right." Cherish those rights. Defend those rights. Pass on those rights.